I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of the Cult Pop Show podcast was brought to you by our Patreon. If you want to tell us which films we should watch, get up to 2 extra exclusive podcasts a month, give us something to talk about in the post-credits scene at the end of each episode, or join us for our monthly movie club Zoom call where we discuss a film together, then please consider joining the cult and donating at www.patreon.com/cultpopshow.
Okay, welcome everybody, welcome back to the Cold Pop Show podcast. It's still Christmas time. Remember when we recorded part one of this podcast all those months ago in November? Do you guys remember that?
No.
It's too long.
I have a relatively loud helicopter buzzing me at the moment.
I can hear it. This is part two of our Netflixmas special. This is our what has become an annual tradition, though I think we need to revise that.
Biannual tradition, is it? Now?
I guess so. Of watching all the either really shit or amazing Netflix films that appear on the platform around Christmas time. They are Netflix exclusives, which is surprisingly harder to figure out than I think people might think. People think, oh, the Cult Pop Show gang, they're doing Netflixmas again this year where they watch all the Netflix Christmas movies. They're not listed anywhere.
Yeah, cool. Netflix will publish their list and the Cult Pop Show boys can just look at that and No,
it's not like that at all. It's more like you've got to look around and see what there is, and then you've got to determine, is this a Netflix exclusive or is this a movie made about Christmas this year that is on Netflix but not a Netflix exclusive?
It just suddenly got released. And the only real way you can tell is if it has the little like Netflix N next to the title of the movie on Netflix.
Mm. Yes. So I will get into that. We did the first 5 of the 11 Netflixmas movies last fortnight, and those were Operation Christmas Drop, the Princess Switch Switched Again, Alien Xmas.
Do like a little one sound review recap from last time.
Yep. Jingle Jangle.
Oh.
And I'm missing one.
Holiday.
And this fortnight we're going to go over 6 more. Which
and Alien
foolishly,
Xmas.
I said Alien Xmas.
Well, fuck. Okay. I'm Richard. Foolishly, and this is AJ and Jeremy.
Yes. God. Okay. Foolishly, I don't have a list in front of me of the 6 we're doing now, even though I just talked about how hard they are to figure out and remember. But let's see if I can do this off the top of my head.
Okay, I do have a list in front of me, but you try.
Oh, they are memorable.
So there, we watched The Christmas Chronicles 2, or Part 2. Part 2? Yeah.
Part 2.
Yep. Just Another Christmas, Angela's Christmas Wish, which was a shorter film, about 40 minutes.
say it in a German accent.
Christmas Crossfire.
Thank you.
And there's 2 more. What one?
Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square.
Yes,
and
Dolly Parton's
Dance
Christmas
Dreams
on the Square.
Hot Chocolate Nutcracker.
Of course. Now,
why did you forget that one, AJ?
It was hard to, because the other forgettable ones pushed their way into my head. They saw my brain cells were quickly forgetting everything, and they all crammed to get in there. Okay, up top, I want to suggest something to you boys on pod about the future of Netflixmas for this podcast. And that is, We either make this the final Netflixmas episode, or we reassess what Netflixmas means. Because last fortnight, we sort of discussed how the idea was, it was like Netflix was doing the Hallmark thing, and they were making these shitty Christmas, you know, disgustingly wholesome, Facebook mum appealing movies. And I think a couple of years ago, that's exactly what they were doing. But now, if it's just a Netflix exclusive that comes out around Christmas time, there's too many, and they're too distinct,
shit,
and they're too specific, and they aren't like. I get where the content is in us talking about the holiday calendar and Christmas Prince 2 or the Princess Switch. I get where the content is there. Where is the content in us talking about Dance Dreams Hot Chocolate Nutcracker? It's gonna take 5 minutes to talk about that.
If that.
Yeah. So that's my, and maybe the listeners can let us know what they think. I think we need to specifically hone in next year for Netflixmas on the Hallmark, you know, style ones and not everything.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
Well, I think we should do all of them forever.
I think each year we should go back and review all of the previous year's ones and then do this year's ones.
Yeah, like a 12 Days of Christmas where it's just exponential.
Right. I did think it could be fun to do a prequel at some point in next Christmas season and do Netflixmas 2017, which was the one that we missed as a podcast.
That would be exponentially easier to do.
Yeah, because isn't it just a Christmas Prince?
Yeah, I mean, I hear you, AJ, and this is also, I mean, this is something that I actually flagged up quite early on in the previous podcast by saying, hey, let's not do the random documentaries. Let's just do the feature films that are about Christmas.
I was watching, it might have been Dance Dreams, it was one of the ones, and I was just like, what is this? This feels like the least podcasty film I've ever watched.
It's the least Christmassy film we've ever watched. Like, it barely had anything to do with Christmas.
I actually have to write them down so they're in front of me. I'm gonna do it. I have to. And so let's do what we usually do, which is talking about them one by one, starting with the worst one. And I'm just trying to write them down. Okay, so I'll cut this out. But there's Dance Dreams.
Are you gonna ruin the order?
No, I'm just writing them down as they come to my head.
Just so that he can think of them.
Okay. Mine doesn't fire blank. Christmas Chronicles 2. Just another Christmas. Angel's Christmas. Christmas Crossfire. And there's one more. Angel's Christmas Watch. No, I got that one. Dolly Parton.
Okay. All right. Okay. Now to say what one we thought was the worst. And if we agree, we'll talk about that one. If we don't, we won't talk about that one? I don't know. okay, so on the count of three, we'll say the one we thought was the worst one from this lot. 3, 2, 1,
Dance
Dolly Parton.
Part two.
Wow! Okay, so is this the first time? No, it probably isn't the first time that all three have been different.
No.
Okay, so Jeremy, you said Dance Dreams. Richard, you said Christmas Chronicles 2. I said Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square. I could honestly be convinced almost either way on what's the worst one for the second, for part two.
Yeah, let's get Dance Dreams out of the way.
Out of the way, please. Okay. Like, it's not necessarily the worst, as in it's the most hateful to watch. It's just the most irrelevant.
Yeah, it's just the one where you're like, what the fuck am I doing? Yeah.
I didn't want to say this is the worst one because I don't begrudge this. It's fine.
Yeah,
I have
no qualms with it. I just did not enjoy what, like, I was just like, ugh. What is this about?
All right, Jeremy, do you want to tell us what it is?
So essentially, this is a documentary that looks at the Debbie Allen Dance Academy in LA, which is a dance academy run by Debbie Allen, who was one of the very early African-American or black ballet dancers in America. And she basically has a dance academy in LA where, you know, sort of your race, your position in life, your class, you know, your ability to pay for lessons doesn't matter. It's all about how good you are and how much you want to dance. And so every year they put on this big version of the Nutcracker, which is a classic ballet that is usually sort of the high point of any ballet academy or any ballet company's year. And that she has changed it to make it the Hot Chocolate Nutcracker, which is basically a sort of much cooler and more involved version of the Nutcracker that mostly children are a part of. And it sort of follows the preparations for that and also talks about, also interspersed with talking about a number of different dances and why the academy was set up.
Hey, and good on them, you know?
Yeah, man. Like, all, yeah, full credit to the boys on this one.
Look, this is just... I don't think we've rarely talked about documentaries on Kolpovshche for the main reason that you find yourself in a trap of just relaying the information the documentary puts forward. And this was, I'm sure if you're really into ballet, I'm sure this fucking slaps, you know? I'm sure this rocks.
I don't think so. The problem with this, and you look on, the thing is, you look online and we are really not obviously the target audience for this because
that's the whole thing.
All the reviews online are like, oh my gosh, 2020 needed this. 2020 needed some
good
news.
Oh my god,
news.
Debbie Allen, yell at me, you crazy bitch.
Oh yeah, yeah. Debbie Allen, you can be nasty to me. But it's just like the problem with this is that it has zero trajectory. It has zero arc. There is no tension. It's just nice people doing nice things with nice results. There's no drama. There's never any kind of like, will they, won't they make it to... I mean, I watched a documentary on TVNZ On Demand a while ago about the career of Misty Edwards, who's the kind of the first... She was the first African-American ballerina to be the principal dancer for a show with the American Ballet Academy or American Ballet Theatre, which was a massive, massive moment. And that was an amazing documentary. And this is essentially all the beats of that documentary, but with children and with no dramatic edge to it at all.
Well, the thing is, and people don't realize this going into documentaries, is like the best documentaries feel like they're made up because the story's so good.
Yeah.
And you look at things like I don't know, any sports or competition based documentary, they're usually based around a big game or show, and as you say, there is a dramatic tension to it.
Yeah.
This is
the best
just...
ones of those are like underdog stories and
And this isn't an underdog story. This is a well-established Broadway, well, not Broadway, but
ballet.
Yeah,
I mean, like some of the kids,
like,
you'd say, are kind of like underdogs, but not like really.
But they don't. But they don't. More... They're not competing against anyone. And there's also they don't cover the audition process in terms of who gets a part and who doesn't get a part. It's essentially a news story that goes on for way too long.
It's a 1 hour 45 minute puff piece. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is the kind of thing, like, in terms of, like, would I recommend this? It's like, you'll know if you're going to like this or not. Like, if the idea of Dance Dreams Hot Chocolate Nutcracker excites you, you'll probably like it. If you don't know what the fuck that is, like, you'll probably find it boring.
And it sucks because I've rarely seen a documentary I didn't like. I think it might be that one of the most... quality assured genres of film out there just because of the nature of it. And I think that... I this could have potentially been my favorite one just because I like documentaries, but it really wasn't. There was one part I liked, and that was when they were doing tap dancing, and that looked very cool at 1.5 speed playback on Netflix, I'll tell you what.
I kind of want to know, the one thing I want to know about this, is Debbie Allen Dance Academy going to get cancelled for cultural appropriation?
Okay, let's talk about that. Right. Oh my god. You pulled a talking point from the bowels of my memory. There is a scene where they, because so essentially the Nutcracker story, which I'm incredibly unfamiliar with, it goes around the world. No. It goes around the world.
The storyline of the Hot Chocolate Nutcracker goes around the world.
It goes around the world. And you've got people who aren't Indian, for example, dressing up as Indian characters, doing Indian dance moves for the Indian scene, and they're very proud of it. They're very, there's not an ounce of like, maybe this needs to be reassessed. They are all very like, yeah, and we can do the head bobble
this
thing.
This is the best, and you know, this is the scene that all the girls want to be a part of, and like, oh, I'm in the Bollywood scene. I'm in the Bollywood scene.
Yeah. I did think that as well. And also on 1.5 speed, those Indian dancers look pretty cool. So that's the Hot Chocolate Nutcracker.
Yeah. Don't
watch
it.
Moving on. All right. Second worst film.
Okay.
Three, two, one.
Christmas Crossfire.
Christmas Crossfire.
Yes.
Okay. Christmas Crossfire feels like a boring nightmare that when I wake up, it immediately leaves my memory.
Yes.
Like, so we found out this existed on Pod last week, last fortnight, and it was described in its pitch to us, Richard, as if the type of Christmas movies you like are more Die Hard than Love Actually or something like that. And as we discussed last fortnight as well, is that the most interesting thing about Netflixmas is you're watching a very easy, tangible, easy to understand way of how target audiences work, because everyone is kind of aimed at a different target audience. And if you are interested in the degrees that Richard and I studied for, this is what it's all about. It's like these discussions, you know, like this is what 90% of the theory was about demographics. And so these are a great kind of field case, you know, a study of those things. And so hearing that they were doing an action movie was like, okay, so at the very least, my caveman,
it's one for the boys,
boy brain will enjoy a movie. It is in German, but I can watch it with a dub on or subtitles.
A very poor dub.
Yeah. I thought this was
shithouse.
Whatever it's hardly about Christmas, my God. Yeah. This
how,
stuck
how
into
dare
Netflix
they?
Spire.
How dare they?
So what does anybody, Richard, can you relay what it's about?
Oh God, no. It's a guy like witnesses an attempted murder, inadvertently stops it by like shouting out. It's like a mob hit kind of thing.
It's so much more than that, though. No. That's one storyline.
Let's get into the relationship storyline.
I'm with AJ that this film has completely left my mind. I did the bare minimum amount of attention that you could technically say I watched this film.
It took me five goes, but I made it through.
So it starts out and it follows, the main character is a college professor. And at the start of the film, a woman who looks like she's been beaten up essentially talks him up at a bar. They sleep together in his van that he lives out of.
Is that the first Netflix Miss Breasts we've seen as well?
I think it might be. Or was there breasts in Holiday? I feel like there might have been breasts in a strip club scene or something in Holiday.
They did say come.
They did say come. Too late. And so the next day, she's like, let's go on a trip into the woods.
No, he needs to go to a conference, right? And she's like, I'll come with you. And they drive through the woods.
I thought she wanted him to go through the woods. Oh, who knows? They go through the woods and get distracted by a guy about to be shot. The main character teams up with that guy in their escape, while the girl he was with is also running away from the mob. By the end of the film, the mob is like her family.
No, I think. So basically, they are in the woods very close to the town that Etta grew up in. So she knows basically all the people in the town. Her family is still there. And essentially, the guy who runs this mob racket, or the sort of the heavies of the town who run like a protection order, his dad owns this massive warehouse that some of the movie takes place in, that has a big sauna in it for some reason. And like, essentially, the young guy who was about to be killed by the mob, he was trying to get off with the mobster's girlfriend, and he's like, I love her, I'm not going to leave her. And then she's ended up going like, hey, dude, you're a bit much. I'm going to make sure you're safe, but then I'm going to go back to Herman, who's the mobster. And then it just ends with the sort of random run around the town while Herman's trying to kill them. And just no one in this movie is worth caring about.
Yeah, it leaves you alone with the guy who's in love with the mobster's girlfriend, and it's like, oh, you want me to invest in this character as much as I've barely invested in the ones we started with for them to be at a solo
scene. By the way, sorry, we also forgot about the scene where the sort of middle-aged cop character tries to rape his Edda, and then she ends up shooting him, and that's just forgotten about.
It's a weird... It's
yeah, you're
a weird,
telling me, Jeremy.
It's a weird movie, and I do have to apologize to the listeners on this one, because this might be the least comprehensible, or the least I've comprehended a film we've watched for the podcast since A Fistful of Dollars. Like, and you know what? We each kind of... This Netflixmas, something magical has happened where we've each kind of picked our own, and we've said, this is my one. This is the one that I'm going to like more than the other two. And as Christmas Crossfire started, I was like, this is going to be my one. My one's going to be Christmas Crossfire. And then, oh my God, I got so over it so fast, and... I would not recommend this film. I don't know if it's supposed to be funny. I don't know if it's supposed to be exciting.
Where is the action in this movie? Like, there's no...
Exactly. Do you know what? It's both too dumb and too smart to be comparable.
Because they try to make some commentary about like dying towns and like the fact that people leave these small towns and leave the old people to sort of, you know, all this sort of stuff. And it's just like... These conversations should not be happening in a movie that is this stupid. But, like, genuinely, I want to know what the elevator pitch to get funding for this movie was.
That, right, because it sounds... The start of it, that it's just a girl and a guy run off together, is so feels like such an improvised storyline that, like, you know, like, they just wrote it as they went along, that... For it to start getting into deeper themes, it's like, what is this, a smart movie or a dumb movie? Because if you're going to compare yourselves to Die Hard, I was excited for this movie because if it's comparing itself to Die Hard, what that says to me is that it's simple and it's easy to follow and it's a simple concept executed to varying degrees of well done.
Because if it was literally just like, a guy foils an attempted murder and then they come after him. That's the entire plot. That's all it needs to be. And throw in sprinkle some dark comedy on there, you got yourself a hit.
Yeah, I agree.
You got the makings of a real stew right there.
So, a movie that I either don't understand, isn't very good, or is really good, and I just didn't understand.
It's definitely not the last one.
But so you're choosing that as your one, AJ?
No, I actually did like one of these. One interesting thing here is that Christmas Crossfire doesn't have a Rotten Tomatoes score, so I actually have no idea what to think
of it. It doesn't have a Rotten Tomatoes score, but it does have two reviews, both of which are fresh, giving it a de facto 100% rating. but both of the reviews, like, one is 2.5 out of 4, the other one is 3 out of 5, so they're both just, like, barely above halfway.
What's the score for Hot Chocolate Nutcracker?
It doesn't have one.
I thought that one.
Well, because it's barely a movie, right? I mean, the thing about this movie is that, like, you know, when you see a movie and someone's like, oh, would you recommend it? If I found out that one of my friends was about to watch this movie, I would actively try to stop them from watching this movie. it's not just I wouldn't recommend it. It's like, no, stop.
Yeah. Dance Streams has one review and it's positive, so.
Okay.
All right, next worst film.
I don't think this needs a countdown because I feel like we should have talked about Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square by this point in whatever
I disagree.
Ranking is. You don't agree?
No, Jeremy, what do you think?
Wait, what have we got left? Sorry.
So Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, Christmas Chronicles 2, Just Another Christmas, and Angel's Christmas Wish.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm with Richard. Christmas Chronicles 2
Christmas
is
Chronicles
aggressively
is
worse than Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square.
Yeah. Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square was almost the best one.
It was, until I watched the last two that I watched. Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square was genuinely, I was like, holy crap, is this the best one of this bunch?
Yeah, but anyway, Christmas Chronicles Part 2, a sequel to 2018's Christmas Chronicles, bringing back Kurt Russell as Santa, now with his real-life wife, Goldie Hawn.
Real-life life partner.
As Mrs. Claus. Yeah. Yeah, the villainous Julian Dennison wants to ruin Christmas.
Directed by Chris Columbus, which should be a good thing.
Yeah.
It's one of those rare cases of a sequel getting a, like, upgrading director from someone you've never heard of to a very established name.
Yeah, like that was the thing, because it was like after the first one, we were like, fuck, like Kurt Russell as Santa is the best on-screen portrayal of Santa in film. But the film's like, you know, so-so. And then it's like Chris Columbus is doing the next one. It's like, fuck, you know, that's not bad. Because so he's done Home Alone, Mrs. Doubtfire, and the first two Harry Potter movies.
Yeah.
Just to my, but he also did Pixels and I Love You, Beth Cooper.
Did he? He did Pixels.
No, he did Pixels. Oh, gosh.
Percy Jackson and the Olympians, the Lightning Thief.
So that's like Chris Columbus should have done the first one. Really, is the problem here, is that he was clearly attracted enough to the idea to do the inferior sequel. So to expand on the plot, what the main human child characters from the first one, the mum is getting has got a new boyfriend. It's Tyrese Gibson, right?
Tyrese Gibson.
Yeah. He accidentally encroaches on Katie, who's the protagonist. He accidentally upsets her when he tells her that his favorite Christmas carol is Oh Christmas Tree, which was her passed on father's favorite Christmas carol.
Yeah, and it's also the worst one.
Yeah, well, not even just the idea of like Christmas carols are fair game. If you're going to get triggered whenever you hear of a Christmas carol, that's stupid.
Yeah, when there's like half a dozen to choose from.
So she tries to get in contact with Santa to sort of like, what is she trying to
they're
do?
They're on a tropical island holiday. And it's kind of blending the two families together with his younger son, who's just a bit younger than her, and her older brother, who was the one that was like, a Pierce always sees it through at the end of the last one. Yeah. But he's aged out of this one now. And so she's still a true believer in Santa Claus. And and essentially she finds the younger child, the Tyrese Gibson's son, annoying, and she also hates the fact that her mum is spending Christmas, and she hates the fact that they're in a tropical island for Christmas because it doesn't feel.
Yeah, so she wants to go cocoa, back.
There's no snow, all that sort of stuff. So she tries to run away,
but then she is transported to the North Pole by Belsnickel,
Julian Dennis's character, who is once upon a time was an elf, and elves in the Christmas Chronicle universe are like more closely like fuzzy marsupials than people.
This movie's answer to Minions.
Yeah. And he used to be an elf, but he essentially adapts the fall of Lucifer, but with Santa as God and Belsnickel as Lucifer, because he is very close with Santa, but upon deciding that he's better than the people they're serving, is doomed by being transformed into Deadpool 2 put it, a portly boy from New Zealand or something like that. All right. It's their battle to receive the Star of Bethlehem, which is the MacGuffin of the film that powers the North Pole. And I liked that they married the Santa mythology with the Jesus mythology.
Yeah, because we also see Santa's origin in Turkey as well.
And I think that's a cool thing this movie did, is that there's always too much of a disconnect between the quote-unquote true meaning of Christmas and the Jesus stuff. I'm kidding. The Santa stuff. And the,
taking the mythology of Saint Nicholas from Turkey and actually giving Santa's backstory of, like, here's how it happened. Here's how he went from being a bishop in Turkey to, like, the Santa we know today. And I thought it was really cool how they did that. Unfortunately...
And it's respectful as well. Yeah. It's not, like, blasphemous.
It's inclusive. It brings all the stories together and says, hey, all of this can sit together and as a nice mythology. Unfortunately, it's wrapped up in the steaming pile of a movie.
Yeah, well, there's also the other kind of main thing that happens is that during the fight with Belsnickel, they end up getting transported back in time to Boston in 1990 at the airport, and they need some AAA batteries to get home. And Kate Pierce ends up running into her father, who's the same age as her. And then Santa does another musical number, because you got to have that in these films, apparently. And then, you know, they save the day. Belsnickel gets turned good again and whatever.
No, Belsnickel just gets shown up, and then they just let bygones be bygones and become his friend again. And I was like, he didn't earn.
After he tried to kill Kate with, like, flaming balls of fire.
Yeah, and also his performance is terrible.
Okay, we need. This is the
There's so much to talk about.
We've outlined the story, and we've outlined the story arc and the characters. Now this podcast has previously discussed the acting capabilities of our local actor, Julian Dennison, made famous in Hunt for the Wilder People, where he played the now very famous role of Ricky Baker, a role which he's pretty good at.
Like, that film is incredible. And he's amazing in it.
And the film also rests on his charisma.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, yeah, the film revolves around him, but that's a testament to the work of Taika Waititi building a film around this kid and him fitting it so perfectly.
And then he was somewhat confoundingly cast in Deadpool 2 in a very dramatic role, a role that offered no flexing of the comedic chops of which he had established his name on. But Deadpool 2 still felt like it, I guess it got away with it.
Well, I think the thing about Julian Dennison, especially in something like Deadpool 2, is that people watch Hunt for the Wilder People and they go, he's funny because he's fat and he has a funny accent. And that's, and then they're like, cool, well, let's get him in our movie. And apparently, so he had to train for Deadpool 2 to be able to do those stunts, but the studio was like, we need you to get in shape because you've got all these stunts to do, but you can't lose any weight. And so he had to, like, get, you know, fit, but still be quite overweight. And it's like, they're telling this to a kid. But, yeah, so that, because that's kind of what everything, like, his career has revolved around. And so you get that in Deadpool 2, and then you watch interviews with him, and he's the funny one, quote unquote. And, like, he says, they go, oh, like, how have you been, Julian? And he's like, oh, yeah, I just got off a flight. And then they're cracking up. You bring that to New Zealand, and he says, oh, I just got off a flight. And they're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, did you have a good flight?
And your accent is normal to us.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of deadpan sort of
speaking,
but yeah,
speaking
like, and so,
of flights though, sorry, yeah. He also starred in an Air New Zealand safety video, something that the company is famous for either swinging or missing with, and his one was decidedly a miss.
The biggest miss.
It's actually like the worst thing I have ever seen in my entire life,
maybe the worst one of all time. And so his star fell a bit, at least in our circles. And I'm very conscious of bad-mouthing an actor that, in the grand scheme of things, I'm more likely to meet in my life or even work with in my, you know, because I'm vaguely in the film. I'm not even stargazing. I'm saying it's not impossible.
We're 2 degrees of separation away from this kid.
Exactly. And so I've always been very nervous of talking about him as badly as you two freely do. But I got to say, man, you either be a movie or you be a Julian Dennison vehicle. And I don't understand why Christmas Chronicles 2 is at both times the perfect role for Julian Dennison, a straight to Netflix Christmas movie, and also spectacularly wrong. And
yeah,
here
a Chris Columbus directed Kurt Russell film. Yeah.
Here is why it's maybe not his fault that he's so bad in this movie. And reader, listener, he's terrible in this film.
He literally doesn't act in the movie.
Yeah, here is why it's maybe not his fault, is that the role that he's playing is supposed to be Kurt Russell's nemesis. He's supposed to be equal to him. He's supposed to be the Lucifer to his God. He's supposed to be, like, what's an actual example of
Jack Frost and Santa Claus in the Santa Claus movie?
Yep, or I was going to say Grindelwald and Dumbledore, which, you know, casting.
Well, they were lovers.
Shit us. But yeah, okay, but you're...
Yeah, well, we don't know that about Belle, Snickle, and Santa.
You're casting equals, you know, when you cast Johnny Depp against Jude Law, it's like, yeah, it's Johnny Depp and Jude Law, and now it's Mad Mikkelsen, et cetera, et cetera. This, like, even if you loved Hunt for the Wilder People, and even if you think Julian Dennison is hilarious, and that's actually okay if you do, he's not as good of an actor as Kurt Russell by any metric.
But also,
of course he's
this
not.
This role is not a comedic role.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he doesn't have jokes. It's, you're not meant to laugh at Belsnickel. You're meant to be like, wow, what a bad elf. Like, that's not a funny role.
And you could have cast, we talked about it in our group chat, but this could have been Paul Giamatti. This could have been Jeff Bridges. Like, this could have been someone who just has a natural charisma and have, because it's also not relevant that he's a 15-year-old kid as well.
Yeah,
like, that's not really part of the role. And so,
and also, I mean, we talked about this, but I even think that in the world of the movie, he shouldn't have been a child. Because Belsnickel, the elf, becoming a human was like a punishment because he didn't obey the elf code.
Yeah, so he should age up.
And he was horrified that he became a human. But I'm like, elves work all year to create toys for children. So surely the biggest punishment for an elf would be to become an adult human, not a basically child.
Ian McKellen. Cast Ian McKellen as Belsnickel. Yeah. Cast Anthony Hopkins as
Belsnickel.
Cast
Betty White.
Have you seen Anthony Hopkins on Twitter? Have you seen the kind of videos that guy posts?
Oh,
he is a lunatic. He posts like videos of him like dancing and cackling with his face 2 inches away from his phone camera. And it's like, you know how when lockdown started happening and everyone was like seeing that celebrities when removed from their publicists is a dangerous thing? Anthony Hopkins is that, man. Like, you go watch the videos he posts and you're like, man, this guy needs... Someone needs to tell him to stop doing these. My point is, he's insane and can play an elf. I struggle because I don't want to be, like, necessarily on the Julian Dennison hate train. I think he's been miscast, but I don't think he will never get a good role again.
Yeah,
but this
is
such a bad role.
It could work in a film like Deadpool 2. Like, that's like the world of Deadpool is made where, you know, you can do that kind of thing. He's in Godzilla vs. Kong. I can't imagine that going well.
No.
the issue with Julian Dennison is this, and it's broadly a child actor issue. The things that enable a child actor to be funny is like, oh, this child is 10 years old and yet they're precocious and they have an attitude like an adult. That is hilarious. You know, like Ricky Baker, he like made kind of sarcastic jokes and didn't care about it. And he was just like, oh, you're too cool. You know, and it was like he's acting older than he looks, which is inherently funny. The problem is when that actor becomes as old, like a child who is like 10 to 12 that acts that way is a novelty. A 17, 18, 19 year old who acts sarcastic and cynical and like world weary and tries to make jokes is literally every single teenage male in New Zealand. That is not special.
Damn right.
He's 18 years old now, which if an actor started at 18, you wouldn't cast them in these, you know what I mean? That'd be an adult
It's
actor.
Not funny for an 18-year-old to be acting that way. And the thing is that, so now he actually has to get by on real, actual acting ability rather than just charm and charisma. And unfortunately, he doesn't have it. And that's proved by... No, he doesn't. I'm sorry. He doesn't have it.
I'm just saying, the right director could utilize him. It's the same. There are plenty of actors who are
sorry.
Like that.
The way that he read those lines and basically, like, what you just said is that basically, you just gave us a whole bunch of other actors that could do this role. And what you're saying is that he couldn't do this role because he couldn't act.
Yeah, no, I just remembered how he delivers his lines.
Yeah.
You're right. Hey, well, look.
also, the whole plan at the beginning of this movie is that he has to use Kate to get to the North Pole because Santa is the only person who can go in and out of Santa's village because he's the only one who can navigate the Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis kind of thing. And so he can't get back into Santa's village. And it's stated that he's the only one that Santa's the only one that can go in and out. And so he has to try and get Kate so that Santa will come and pick her up. But it's like, what's the guarantee that Santa would even find her? Like, how did, like, the whole...
He found her by coincidence in the film.
The whole plan is just so poorly thought out. And then he hitches a ride on Santa's sleigh. And then can we get into Mrs. Claus?
I was just going to mention her as we were wrapping up. There's a lot of, like, armchair feminism in this film. It's that kind of, it's the, what Disney's been doing with like Mulan and Dumbo, where they go, oh, we'll have a woman who's like into science, and then be like, okay, cool, that's feminist. But because there's the whole thing about like, why do you never really hear about Mrs. Claus? And then it ends with the male one going on the adventure, being like, I'll never forget you, Mrs. Claus. And she says, you will. And that's how you will from time to time, and that's how it should be.
What did that line even mean?
I know. I genuinely have no idea what that means.
Yeah. Like, is that part of the myth of Christmas, that you're just supposed to forget Mrs. Claus from time to time?
But going back, there's some real creepy, like, locked in kind of vibes with Mrs. Claus. Because first of all, when the children arrive, it's like the first time she's met children in years, and she's so excited because Mrs. Claus loves kids and loves hanging out with them. And I'm like, well, why the hell have Mrs. Claus and Santa never had kids? And like, why hasn't Santa gone, hey, why don't we adopt some kids or something? And then it's stated specifically, she says, Santa's the only one who can get in and out of Santa's village, which means that he's got her locked up in the village. She can't go out and, you know, hang out with kids or whatever. And the whole thing is just real weird. Like,
Santa could have a whole slew of kids and she doesn't know.
And it's all Julian Dennison's fault.
So also for the record, this has 73% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
But like every review I've seen is like, yeah, the first one wasn't too bad, but fuck, what the fuck was this one?
I don't know. I think there was enough in this one for me to probably rank it at the top, to be honest with you guys.
What?
No, here's the thing about Netflixmas that I've lost you guys in. I don't like any of these fucking movies. I don't like any of these, and you guys are like, how can you rank it above this? And it's like, because they're all fucking bad. They're all bad. That's why, because I'm picking the best of a bad bunch, and this had like the more professional production values, and it had a performance in Kurt Russell that I really enjoy, and it's like, that's enough for it to bump itself up probably to the top of the cream of the crop. Which actually it's not. I do have a favorite that isn't this one. But by and large,
you do like one of them.
Yeah, but it doesn't count, and we'll talk about why. by and large, how can I be so crap on Jingle Jangle, Richard? It's because I don't like any of these movies. How can I be so crap on the next one I'm sure we're going to talk about? It's because I don't like any of these movies. And this had Kurt Russell in it, and that's enough for me.
You're insane. all right, so next worst one, I think we can all agree is
Dolly Parton's Christmas on
Angela's
Square.
Christmas Wish.
No, I think it's Dolly Parton's Christmas.
Yeah, it's
Dolly
Parton, yeah.
Okay, so Dolly Parton's Christmas Wish. I just have to.
Dolly Parton's
this.
Christmas on the Square. So,
Dolly Parton's Christmas Chronicles Wish. Chocolate Nutcracker.
Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square is a fever dream of a musical. So Jingle Jangle, let's just say that's Broadway. So in terms of the quality of the production, in terms of what's been put in terms of the performers, the way that it's presented to you, Jingle Jangle is a Broadway production with that kind of level of performance and the money that's
Broadway.
Put behind it. And if Jingle Jangle is Broadway, Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square is a community theater production put on by someone who works at your workplace in their spare time, and they've invited you along, and you go along, and you're like, oh my God, this
man
is so awkward.
I've been the person doing a community theatre play that's invited a workmate. to that poor guy. It was Jeremy. You remember?
Oh.
So what's this actually about? It's It's your classic crotchety old woman's gonna shut down the town by Christmas.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
she learns to love again.
It's the Christmas trope of character who hates Christmas, which is, I guess, a Christmas trope.
Yeah. It's kind of like a Christmas Carol, where Scrooge, Ebenezer Scrooge, it kind of owns, or you know, can financially seriously impact a large number of people just before Christmas. So Christine Baranski plays a woman whose father owned all of the land that a town is built on, and he has passed away, and so now she owns it. She serves notice to the whole town on Christmas Eve that basically says, I'm selling this town to the Cheetah Mall Corporation, and this whole town is going to be bulldozed to create a mall, and they quickly rally and protest. I'm not sure exactly how their protests would have worked. There's also a guardian angel who happens to be Christine Baranski's PA. That guardian angel is being trained. She's not yet a guardian angel. She's a guardian angel in training, which is something that's borrowed heavily from from It's a Wonderful Life. And that guardian angel is being trained in how to be one by Dolly Parton herself, who is the angel that is kind of the Greek chorus slash the narrator slash anything she wants to be, because she's bloody Dolly Parton and she's amazing.
And that's the target audience, is people who think that.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, totally.
I've got no connection to Dolly Parton. I know, like, she did Jolene. That's right. Yeah. That's about as much as I know.
Personality and a great businesswoman.
She also wrote And I Will Always Love You.
She originally performed it as well.
Okay.
Yeah, but she's this film as well. And you know, I watched this at work on a late shift, and I remember thinking, I'm gonna commit these, because I was like, fuck, I'm actually kind of enjoying this. I was like, I need to commit some of these songs to memory, because Jeremy was like, sing one last week when I said I like Jingle Jangle. And you know what? I've completely forgotten them. But you know what? I still remember Magic Man G from Jingle Jangle, because it was a good song.
I don't remember.
I went
anything.
Back and listened to the songs from Jingle Jangle, and they're just as bad as I thought they were.
I don't even remember what song Santa sings in Christmas Chronicles 2.
Yeah.
Why would you?
Because, good point. Because I watched that one like yesterday.
I think that Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square is like the most hallmark of all the movies we've watched. In terms of this extremes of every character in this film is going through the most extreme emotional event of their life. So there's a pastor character, and he and his wife, the first moment we're introduced to them, they own, how's this for torture? They own a baby supply store, and they can't have their own babies. And they're hoping Christmas wish is that they can maybe have a baby this year. And then Christine Baranski, not only has she lost her father this year and she's shutting down the town, she also thinks she has a brain tumor that's going to kill her really soon.
The brain tumor thing was a raisin in the salad of this movie. But it was like, what are you doing? Why is there a brain tumor
but
plot?
There's every plot. Like, every character has this massive, like, tension going on in their life.
Oh, she also had a miscarriage earlier in life, by the way.
But I kind of love all these things in the film. Like it all comes together. Like, if you accept that this is, like, just full cheese, it's like... Yeah, I don't know. I didn't dislike watching this one, I guess is what I'm saying. Because it's like, oh, what are they going to do next? And because we, like, last week, you know, Jeremy, you called it a concert, and I corrected you saying it's a variety show. It's neither. It's just a very, very cheesy film. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a staged movie, because it's adapted from a stage play. Yes. Yes, it is.
No. I think it's just it's an original.
Essentially, there's like an album to go with it. But also, it's directed and choreographed by Debbie Allen.
It's a Christmas miracle.
Yeah, I mean, despite my initial feelings about, like, oh gosh, this is so embarrassing, I have to say, Christine Baranski totally does the work for this movie. She is such a good actress that she manages to carry off the most ridiculous string of plot elements to the point where I actually cared about her character, even though she was... The character was written to be the most broadly sketched comic villain that you could possibly find. Yeah. And yet
20 minutes in, I'm like, oh my God, she's the protagonist.
Yeah.
I keep being like, when's the protagonist going to show up to face off against this evil villain? And then I was like, oh, it's the Christmas Carol. Sorry.
And she's everything. The That's the thing. She's both the villain and the protagonist. She is basically carrying the entire weight of this preposterous cheese on her shoulders. And it's a testament to her talent. She does it.
Preposterous cheese.
on her shoulders.
Yeah. Very nice. Well, I am forgetting this like snowflakes falling on an untarnished snowy plain. I am forgetting this movie snowflake by snowflake. Shall we?
What are you saying?
I've been watching too many Netflix Christmas movies, and now my metaphors are all out of whack. What shall we move on to the next one?
Yes.
Okay. So that's Dolly Parton's.
We can all agree on the next worst one, though.
No. Okay. Here, whatever you think it is. I think we should talk about Angela's Christmas Wish last to mirror how we talked about Alien Xmas last at the end of last episode, because they're both
Alien Xmas was actually the best one.
Well, I think Angela's Christmas is the best one. There, I said it.
Jeremy, do you want a tie break?
I also think that Angela's Christmas Wish is the best one.
All right.
Let's talk about
the
just
best
another
one,
Christmas,
just another Christmas,
which is a where is this one from?
Brazilian.
It's a Brazilian. It kind of pitches itself as a Christmas time loop movie, but it's more like Click, the Adam Sandler movie.
So it's a guy gets knocked out on Christmas 2010, and then wakes up, and it's Christmas 2011, and then when he goes to bed. He wakes up and it's Christmas 2012, and he's just skipping through his life, experiencing only the Christmases.
But he's
cursed
by an old
man.
He actually exists for the rest of the year. There's another version of him, basically, with that memory that exists for the rest of the year, and then he reappears from like the 2010 timeline for one day each year, but he realizes that basically he is living his life the rest of the year.
Yeah, so he's essentially like catching up on his life and seeing all these horrible decisions he made and whatnot. He finds out about having an affair and like leaving his wife, and then they end up back together, and all these things happen to him, and he's only kind of just getting these glimpses of his life. And it is very much like it's essentially a cross between 50 First Dates and Click, two Adam Sandler movies, because it's a guy rapidly skipping through his life, missing out on so much, but then also having to be caught up each time. Very 50 First Dates-ish. This starts off as a very dumb comedy about this guy who's very wacky. He hates Christmas. He's got longish curly hair, and everything that can go wrong will go wrong at Christmas. And then the next Christmas is like, what am I doing? I don't remember any of this. And then it skips ahead like five or six Christmases at one point. And now he's got short hair. His marriage isn't what it used to be.
A mustache.
And then all these like harsh realities start setting in. Him and his wife, he's cheating on his wife. That's why he grew a mustache, because his mistress liked
that. Happens when you cheat on your wife.
Yeah, it's like this.
It's like getting pimples on your tongue when you lie.
Spoilers for Just Another Christmas, which I would recommend watching. Then Christmas, he finds out his daughter, who we meet as a very young little girl, his daughter now has a child and breast cancer, and it's too late to do anything about it. And then the following Christmas, she's dead.
It's a package deal.
And it's much like Click. It starts as a very dumb comedy, and then at the end, you're like, oh my God, this
is horrible.
It wallops
you.
Yeah.
I was
really taken back by this, because I watched the first half on the bus at 1.5 speed, and it was like, this very wacky, silly, everyone's moving fast. And then, my God, when I watched the latter half at home on normal speed, It really
what
worked.
An experience. That's almost a whole podcast concept right there.
it's almost like watching movies at the speed that they were intended to be watched at. Really gives us different quality.
Yeah. Look, it's in the end he is able to go back to Christmas 2010.
Having now learned the meaning of Christmas.
Yeah, and you know, he can he makes sure that his daughter is going to check for lumps, I guess, as she gets older. Well, because they explicitly say in the movie, "I didn't get it checked in time," which is how they go. Because if they don't say that, then he's just going back in time to experience the inevitable death of his daughter.
Yeah, but much slower. And yeah.
And okay, I thought,
which is called the arrival ending.
Yeah. I thought, look, I didn't really like this movie. I thought some of the performances were fun in the first half, but I wasn't crazy about it. But I also don't like Click for the same reason. I don't like that Click is a drama disguised as a comedy, especially with like actors who like aren't the best in dramatic roles.
I feel like ultimately, that's the kind of thing that in a different thing you would like, though.
I don't like jarring tonal shifts in movies.
Well, actually, yeah, you have stuck to that.
Yeah, I'm consistent.
I'm now understanding another reason why you don't like my favorite movie of all time, About Time. Because About Time does exactly the same thing and ends with pretty much exactly the same message.
It's better in About Time because the tone is more consistent all the way through. This literally goes from like Jack and Jill to Atonement.
Jack and Jill. Well, so don't mess with the Zohan.
For all the things I don't like about Time, I wouldn't begrudge its handling of the dramatic with the comedic. I also thought though, like the idea of waking up once a year for however many years he wakes up for, and it goes past 2020, it goes into the future. Mm. That is a concept so existentially terrifying to me because he's what, 38? 39 in the first one. That's, you can now count approximately how many days you've got left to live.
And also how many days you've got left until all of your friends and family die.
And that is not, the existentialism of this is not even mentioned. And that to me was such a terrifying concept of it. And when I read the plot synopsis, like the Netflix one, which gives you like a couple of sentences, and I was like, oh, it's Groundhog Day, but on Christmas.
Yeah, that's kind of what it's made out to be like, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, what a great and also like obvious idea. I can't believe some Brazilian comedy is the first one to do that. But it's not that, and I think that would be less existentially terrifying because you don't get older and you're actually immortal in a time loop situation.
This movie is to Groundhog Day what Christmas Crossfire is to Die Hard.
You're right. And I'm not, this isn't going to be like last week, Richard, when you were like, I love Jingle Jangle. And I was like, I did not love it. This is more like you could tell me all the things you would love about this movie. And I'd be like, yeah, that was great. And I just thought it was still a bad movie.
You're talking about the existential crisis of it. I thought that was like when it was, because, you know, you do the typical thing on like a time loop movie where you set up like a very specific set of events and you can tell that that's what they're setting up. And then, so there's things like the turkey gets burnt or like the guy runs away with the turkey and there's like, he discovers a cake in the fridge and all this stuff. And then even when he wakes up for the second Christmas, I was like, oh yeah, here's this coming. But there was a few things that were different. Like the color of the post-its on the mirror was different. And I was like, oh my God, like, is this like a time loop movie where he can actually change things? Or it's like he wakes up in a slightly, and I was so fascinated by it. And then realizing it was the following year, I was like, fuck, that's a good idea. That I like, for me, I was like, this is, I can't believe I haven't seen this before. And like, obviously this Click, but he's in control and he knows like when it is. But the fact of like just waking up a year later and you've lived a life completely, I thought it was incredible.
Yeah, and I think it's also concept. it's quite a hard concept to actually explain, and I think they do a really good job of getting the audience to be like, oh, so that's what's happening, you know, without showing the rest of the family throughout the rest of the year living with the dad who is not that dad.
Yeah, because we only get one glimpse of the rest of the year, George, which is when his mistress essentially is like, no, we have a happy life together. Look, you recorded this message, you know, a month ago. And it's like, it's very obviously written, and she's off screen telling him what to say, and he doesn't look fully into it. But I thought it was a fascinating, like, not showing us everything. And I just thought it was so clever.
Do you think this is one of those movies where if it was made in the 80s and was probably would have to be American for this to be the case, it was kind of like a tentpole in 80s film like Groundhog Day?
Yeah.
Do you think that there would be crack.com articles written about it where it's like, from a different perspective, the story you're told is the bad one? Because I couldn't help but think that two Christmases on, like, removed from his failed marriage where he's with someone else, and one day of the year he's who he was 10 years ago, that, like, maybe I would understand why he'd be upset, but maybe he's, like, happier being, for the rest of the year, he's happier being with the woman he's with. Like, people make mistakes and they move on and they fall out of love. But if I was in a situation and I had, you know, moved on and gotten a divorce and was with someone new, I'd be very frustrated if for one day of the year I intentionally would sabotage myself to, like, pull myself back to what I wanted 10 years
but
ago.
At the same time, we are explicitly shown that he's not actually happy the rest of the year. Well, we're not explicitly shown. It's implied by the video he's forced to record.
Yeah, and I think there's the idea that he made mistakes and he let things go with his like his wife, and he's kind of ashamed of that, and this is the life he's living now, and it's just easier to kind of, you know, just go along with
because
it.
Because he forgot the true meaning of Christmas.
And the time loop, whatever you want to call it, situation gives him the unique perspective to see his character flaws.
And also
that position.
And also the sense of, like, it's not my fault. I'm not the person who did this. And so I've got to get back to what I really want. Like, I've got to get back to the right thing.
It's the ghost of Christmas future, but an entire, like, you're seeing all of them.
Yeah. I also thought that you don't actually see him fix anything. It's just one Christmas he wakes up and he's back with his wife.
No, and it's like the emotional labor of actually getting back together with her. He basically puts on the wife. By the way, getting back to your point about the 80s kind of American version of this, John Candy or like Jim Belushi, as the main character, I think that would be a great vehicle.
Oh, he's a hop, skip, and a jump away from every comedy leading man from 20 years ago.
Yeah, this guy.
I would genuinely love to see an Adam Sandler remake of this.
I think I would like a remake more, probably. I think tonally,
it's hard to get on board with, like, actors we've never seen before in anything, language that we haven't seen before and we can't understand unless
some language we've never seen before.
but like, you know, a terrible dub doesn't help it either. And so, and tonally, it's quite obviously different cultures have different ways of being funny and different sort of, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I think that it took me a while to take this movie on its own terms, and once I did, it was really enjoyable.
That's a good way to put it. Do you know what the best joke in this movie was?
What's that?
Is that it's like his 17th Christmas. The whole family knows he's a different person on Christmas. He opens the door to let one of the relatives in, and he makes a pun or says something, some lame joke to, like, this crotchety old man, and the crotchety old man looks at him and goes, "You wake up once a year to say this shit." I love that. I actually laughed at that, so that was fun.
Yeah. So, I mean, I did not expect to be hit as hard by this movie at the end as I was. And I think that was, you know, largely to do with the fact that I've got a daughter, and, like, just genuinely sort of, and this kind of movie makes you get all misty eyed about kind of, it makes you think about what is your life heading towards, you know,
makes,
like,
you think about the true meaning of Christmas.
Well, and where, you know, if you're to look really far ahead, what are the things that you want to invest in now so that things go well in the future. And I mean, that's, you know, It's a Wonderful Life, that's A Christmas Carol, it's all these Christmas movies where it's like, hey, take this one time in the year to look ahead and go, who are you happy with the way you're living your life and what it's creating around you? And I think this movie does a really good job of that, and does a really good job of seeing, and it's cheesy as it might be, I think he actually does a pretty good job of actually bringing in the emotional center of it. And the actress who plays his daughter, I think, does an excellent job of that. But oh my gosh, Shrek almost ruins it.
Oh my God, what a great talking point. I'm so glad you remember. Okay, so some movies have Star Wars. Some movies, if they don't have enough money, they use Night of the Living Dead. There is an agreed upon canon on movies that can be used within movies, I think. Psycho's one of them. I would say even Shrek 1 could be used as this. The movie that's at the emotional heart of this film.
The movie
film.
That the daughter loves more than any other movie and her father refuses to watch with her at all is...
Is not Shrek. It is not Shrek 2. It is the 20-minute special short film feature Shrek the Halls, because that's about Christmas. And it plays like... It does a thing where you'll see like a scene of it on TV and it's supposed to be like, oh, of course, that iconic scene from Shrek the Halls. It's like, I've seen Shrek the Halls twice. I don't remember. And that's more than I should have seen it. I don't remember these scenes. It's such a strange... It should have been... Like that we talked about last week, that Rankin Bass Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, or I don't, maybe in Brazil Shrek the Horses.
like how Snoopy's Christmas is only popular in New Zealand.
Yeah, people
Christmas
don't realize that Shrek the Halls is actually based off another movie.
Yeah, it's like it's the, they don't know about Shrek, they just know about Shrek the Halls. Like I yeah, that was so strange. It reminded me of that. I feel like this is a very obscure thing that we've brought up so many times on the podcast and relative to how easy it is to explain. But there's a movie called World's Greatest Dad where Robin Williams quotes Simon Pegg about zombies. And it's like, why is it so weird that Robin Williams is quoting Simon Pegg?
Why is a character in a film quoting IMDb trivia that I would quote to AJ?
Yeah, well, and it felt like along the same lines as that. That is like Shrek. Most people probably don't know Shrek the Halls exists, and it's like serves as the emotional MacGuffin of the whole film.
I thought it was,
and
nice.
Also I think there's a generational aspect to the films that are allowed to be talked in films. They need to be part of a kind of a classic canon that we've all agreed on. Like, you know, it wouldn't be weird for, you know, say the characters in this movie to, you know, and let's just bring it into the English language fold. Like, you know, if they were quoting from It's a Wonderful Life or Home Alone or even Love Actually would be a movie that's considered to be culturally...
You mean Christmas Crossfire, Richard.
Oh, sorry. they should have been watching Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square.
But for it to be Shrek the Halls and for the characters in the movie to make kind of emotional, like, realization points around, like, you look like Shrek and Mum is Princess Fiona and, like, all this sort of stuff, it's like... No, this is too casual.
I can't explain this. I can't quite articulate this. But a similar thing happened to me many years ago when a friend of a friend gave me their sitcom pilot to critique. And the weirdest note I had to give them was one of the characters was like an idiot. So he was nicknamed Homer as a reference to Homer Simpson. And I was like, you can't do that. You can't. Homer is not ubiquitous with the concept of stupid that you can just assume
the character of Homer is too broad.
They should have given you a pass over the Zombieland 2 script then.
I thought the same thing when I saw Zombieland 2, as they call some of the zombies Homers, and I was like, this feels not accurate.
You were like, enough people know who Homer Simpson is.
But it's not that, is it? I can't explain it. That's my whole point.
Also, not
I
enough
might
people,
cut this part out.
Not enough people know Homer Simpson solely as an allegory for stupidity, like it just as stupidity, because he's too rich of a character over the years.
I disagree. I think Homer Simpson is probably one of the most recognizable characters on the planet.
Yes, but not just for being like simple and dumb.
I should not have brought this up.
Okay, feel free to cut it if you want.
No, don't. Leave it.
All right. Shall we talk about
the worst one?
It's not the worst one. All right. The last one we've got to talk about today is a 40-minute sequel, which I found out well late into this project, called Angela's Christmas Wish. It's a sequel to Angela's Christmas, which was part of Netflix's 2017, which maybe we'll rediscover someday.
Wee.
Some Christmas in the future.
Just another Christmas.
It's a CGI Irish story. It's about a little girl in what time?
Computer CGI generated Irish.
1913.
Her dad's off in Australia for some reason. And so the mum's looking after the kids. He's not a crook, is he? He's like
No. Basically, at this time in Irish history, so this is taken from the writings of Frank McCourt, who's the guy who wrote the book *Angela's Ashes*. And he's very well known for writing like kind of scorching kind of histories of how hard it was in periods of Ireland's history, and essentially talking about like the men. There was no work to be found at all, and so in order to actually survive, men had to go find opportunity over in places like Australia, work and send money home. And so essentially right at the beginning of this film, literally in the first 30 seconds, this cute tiny toddler child, this little girl Angela, is abandoned by her father with like barely a word spoken,
and a concept she only understands as he waves at her from the boat.
And like, I was not prepared. Like, genuinely, I went straight from the end of Just Another Christmas watching this girl die of breast cancer and like and the father have to say goodbye to her. And then we go straight into this tiny toddler who's around the age of Ivy at the moment being abandoned by her father because he has to go. And I was just like bawling my eyes out. I was like, I can't deal with this.
So the rest of the story is set a couple years later, and it's nearing Christmas, and Angela's big Christmas wish is that she'll get a doll, a really pretty doll. And I'm trying to streamline summarizing it. Essentially, they think that the thing their mum wants for Christmas is for their da to come home, and they kind of work out, they try to catch a train to Australia from looking at an atlas, and it ends up being like they can convince the horty-torty town vet to look after someone's baby cow if they can bring the dad home. And it's like these naive children thinking it's very easy to get someone home from Australia, essentially, is what you need to know. Very adorable performances from these little Irish children. And in the end, it turns out, after they fail to get their da home, it turns out that the mum's special surprise, which Angela thought was the doll, was actually the dad coming home. And maybe that was obvious. I did not see it coming.
What?
I did not see it coming. No, and say what you want about me being dumb because of that. Okay?
You're such a homer.
Fine. I'll take the L. I'll take it. Like, what? Maybe I'm dumb for not realizing this, but put yourself in my shoes and imagine how fucking emotional I felt when she turns around and you think, I figured that she probably wasn't going to get the doll, that it would be like, the real meaning of Christmas is not possessions. So I knew it wasn't going to be
family, her dad coming home.
But I didn't give the movie enough thought to see that part coming. And so when she turns around and sees her dad, and they animate a very nuanced and realistic reaction, which is like, she almost doesn't look happy. She looks like it's like she loses her breath and sort of crumples. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It's a fucking beautiful bit of animation because it's not like, well, oh my God, dad's home. It's, I don't know how to process this. I can't understand what's happening. Yeah.
And I watched this in class when I should have been working, and I was nearly, I welled up, and I was like, oh my God, like particularly that piece of animation, which I'm glad you guys picked up on as well. It was just so, it reminded me of an Inside Out when she like lets out the breath at the end, the like stuttered breath, where it's just like this profound emotional response that I immediately recognized, but never knew I recognized
it's
before.
It's profoundly human.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I was so the rest of the movie is like, I don't dislike it, it's fun, whatever. But then it got that to point and I was like, oh my God, I feel so emotionally involved in this now. And it was so sweet and so beautiful and so like taps through the cynical shell that makes up me as a person. And was it's the first time in a long time that a Christmas movie has been able to sincerely show me the true meaning of Christmas and not have me roll my eyes and go, yeah, it's family.
Aww, you know? And all so it funny. Took was for a 5-year-old girl to truly be the audience surrogate for you.
I can't get over the fact that you didn't know that was coming. Father leaves at the start of the film. He's obviously going to come back at the end.
That's a Chekhov's gun. It's a Chekhov's gun, AJ.
I just peeked. I'm sorry. God damn it. I'm going to have to cut that out.
No, that's amazing.
I know. I know, and like, whatever. It's not because I'm stupid. It's because I wasn't thinking about the movie for most of the time I was watching it, right? I was, like, passively watching it while, if my bosses are listening, I was simultaneously doing other work.
Yeah, like, I've spoken how Call Me By Your Name took me by surprise because I didn't realize I cared about it until the end was like,
right.
Oh, shit. And then, like Paddington 2 has a very similar ending, and I fucking cried at that. When it's like when Aunt Lucy shows up. My God, what a good movie.
I think I even knew the dad would come back. It's just the specific
thing. Oh, now you're backtracking.
I'm trying to remember. I think it was less that I didn't think the dad would come back and more that I didn't realize that the Christmas surprise that I'd been hyped up from the whole short film was going to be the dad coming back.
Watching this whole movie be like, yo, can't wait for that Christmas surprise.
Seriously, and like, oh, I genuinely, I'm you're not dumb, and you get movies, so
I'm trying to convey.
I'm not thinking that you're dumb, I'm just so flummoxed by how you could not have picked up on all of the, like, beats where, like, the mother's super excited, and she's cleaning everything, and like...
Yeah.
Man, I get it. I agree with you. But it means I like...
Yeah, you had a really wonderful experience.
Yeah, you can measure how much more I enjoyed this
movie. You
would
have had the same beautiful reaction as Angela.
Yeah.
I wish I'd seen your face.
That's so
I
funny.
Was crying. I had tears in my eyes. It was a wonderful experience. I did not expect this movie to be like one of the only movies in the last 20 years to make me cry.
And all it took was for you to be momentarily idiot.
I just found this predictable, to be honest.
Like, when is it predictable?
All right, so this is your one then, is it, AJ?
I loved this. I thought it was beautiful. I'd actually be keen to go and watch Angela's Christmas.
Yeah.
It is weird that these are 40-minute short films when they feel like episodes from a TV show. It's strange.
Yeah.
But maybe they don't have the budget.
I don't want to have Jingle Jangle as mine because I liked Just Another Christmas way more than it.
Hmm. Okay.
But also Jeremy likes Just Another Christmas, so... Maybe we just don't have any.
Yeah, I think we don't need to settle on one.
We don't need to subscribe to AJ's everyone. Theory that we all have one.
The true meaning of Netflixmas is realizing they're all bad.
Except Klaus.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Like, we're never going to get another Klaus on this.
No. So, the true meaning of Netflixmas is... Hallmark-esque movies, as I said at the start.
And speaking of which, next year, a little preview, we're going to get some more of these. There's a couple that have been announced already. As we mentioned last week, there is a Princess Switch 3 coming next year. And there's also a film called A Castle for Christmas, starring Cary Elwes and Brooke Shields.
Oh, cool.
You say, oh, cool, like it's going to be good.
Yeah. Hey, well, that is Netflixmas for 2020. Woohoo! We made it through. Let us know what your favorite Netflix Christmas movie was this year, and what you think we should do about the predicament that is a very practical problem to have too many movies that aren't listed anywhere on any website. Netflix doesn't tell you, and so this is becoming harder and harder as the films exponentially increase.
As they, as they, what we like to call hudgens.
Oh, speaking of exponential increases, something happened between our last record and this record, is that someone at Netflix has clearly listened to this podcast.
They copied me.
Oh, yeah.
They copied me.
Jeremy, do you want to explain what happened?
Well, a friend of the pod, Eric Peterson, sent us all in a very excited manner, sent us all message on Instagram. He sent us a trailer from The Princess Switch. Is it? It was kind of like a joke.
It was like Netflix Instagram or something.
Yeah,
like
Netflix
that.
Instagram made like a joke trailer about like how, you know, basically The Princess Switch is just going to go on forever and ever, and they're just going to keep adding Vanessa Hudgens, different Vanessa Hudgens. But the ending of it was to advertise a movie that had the suffix Princess Switch Switcheroo.
which is exactly
what I called it.
That's what we said last time, was we should get exponential Vanessa Hudgenses and it should be called Princess Switch Switcheroo. And that's too much of a coincidence.
I still think it should just be called Switched Again with an exclamation mark.
And then the next one is Switched Again with a question mark.
Switched again? And the twist is they didn't switch. Okay, so that is Netflix Miss 2020, everybody. If you liked this, please go and subscribe to us on all the podcasting platforms. You can also find our YouTube videos over on YouTube, and you can like Cult Popture as a general conglomerate over on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You can also support us on Patreon, patreon.com/coldpopshire, and you can join our Discord, which there'll be a link to in the show notes. Merry Christmas, guys. Merry Christmas, Jeremy. Merry Christmas, Richard.
The true meaning of Christmas is spending time together with you guys. This has been great.
Yep, let's do it all again next year.
It just sucks that I have to watch all these stupid movies just to hang out with you.
Stay tuned for our post-credit scene as well. See you later, everybody. And to all, a see you later, everybody. Hello and welcome to the post-credit scene. It's just Richard and AJ now. And this is a segment at the end of each episode after the little musical outro. It should be called the post-outro scene, Richard.
Very funny.
Okay, I wasn't trying to be funny.
But you succeeded, I'll tell you what.
This is where if you pay $5 or more on our Patreon, patreon.com/coldpopshire, you get to give us something to talk about in this, the post-credits scene. And this comes to us from David Draper, who says, "This may be an easy question to answer, but I've had some friends ask about the chances of another live show in Christchurch sometime. Is that a question?" It is a question.
It's not a question, Professor.
That's like my favorite Simpsons joke. we can answer this. It's not a particularly fun or wacky post-credits question to ask. We kind of improvise doing our live shows very close to when they happen. We've done two so far.
Oh, yeah.
One last year and one the year before, both around Christmas time. There are no current plans for one this year. Part of the issue being that Richard and I live in different cities, whereas if we lived in the same city, I reckon we'd probably do more potentially. So no is the answer. There are no plans for one, but I'm not opposed to doing
it. Yeah, but also I am
future.
Going to be in Christchurch in a week from today. So who knows?
What do you want to do?
Should we do another improv episode as a live show?
Absolutely not. if people aren't laughing at me because there's no one else in the room, that's fine. But if I'm in a room full of people and they are not laughing at me, then no, absolutely not.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh yeah, like maybe we'll do definitely there will be more live shows to come, I imagine. But yeah, whether or not there happens to be one this Christmas, which is which is when we've generally done them. Yeah, remains to be. It's not out of the realm of possibility, but it's also we don't have anything planned just as of yet.
It's hard to do live shows with our show as well. I feel like we've got to the point where our show is so like you gotta listen to multiple, like a lot of our live show audiences are people dropping in because they've heard about it and not because they're fans.
Yeah,
of
well,
the
I
show.
Wonder
and
maybe
I
like could we do a live show that isn't Film Franchise Fortnights?
I think that's probably both. yes, we can, and is what we should have done this whole time.
If anyone's got any suggestions for a format of our show that would work well as a live show, maybe, yeah. Because we could do a game show or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Could do, what was the game I did on Happening? Actual Movie or Cheese Dream? Could do
that. Yeah.
Could just reignite Soda Popture.
Do a live Q&A.
God.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine that. Come to and ask me a question. Who are you? I'm AJ from Cult Popshire. I don't know what either of those things are.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.